Thank you all for coming today. I'm Henry Olson, a vice president here at the American Enterprise Institute, and I'd like to welcome you to today's address. When most Americans hear New Jersey, they think Tony Soprano, Snooki, traffic jams on the NJT. But that's changing because of Chris Christie. Simply put, he is the most consequential governor of New Jersey in at least 100 years since Woodrow Wilson changed his address from Drumthwacket to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, this governor has ruled out a similar move down I-95 this cycle. But he's a national figure nonetheless, as is attested to by today's announcement that he'll serve as the Republican Governors Association new chair for vice chair for policy. He's won his battles by introducing New Jerseyites to what he calls a culture of truth. And the truths that he tells are inconvenient for his entrenched state legislature, but they echo what New Jersey's and America's people believe. He's won his political battles and captured the public imagination with his plain speech and passion. The bridge across the Delaware River reads, "Trenton makes, the world takes," and the political revolution Chris Christie has made is being taken up by many other governors all across America. Today he brings his truth-telling from the Jersey Shore to the banks of the Potomac, and I believe he'll do so with a dose of what he called in his State of the State address, a little Jersey attitude. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Governor Chris Christie.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation to be here today. And I came today because I really think it's extraordinarily important for those of us who believe that our country is off on the wrong track to begin the conversation, and for New Jersey's sake, to continue the conversation about how we fix the problems that ail our states and our country in a direct and blunt way. And I fear that after watching how things have been going over the last month or two, that we're missing a historic opportunity. And I will not be someone who will participate in silently missing that opportunity. A month ago, I gave my State of the State speech in New Jersey, and what I said during that speech was that I was not going to do the normal State of the State or State of the Union speech that you see. George Will put it better than I ever could. He said these speeches have become every politician's attempt to stroke the erogenous zones of every constituency in their jurisdiction. They become these laundry list things that you do for your cabinet so that as they're sitting up in the balcony, you mention the Department of Labor and that commissioner can sit up straight and smile because it's the time his mother is going to see him on TV. I didn't think that was a good enough reason, as much as I love my commissioner of labor, to give a speech like that, especially during these times. During these times, I said in that speech, it's time to do the big things, the really big things. And I don't think there would be much disagreement in this room, and I don't think there should be much disagreement across the country about what those big things are, what they are for New Jersey and what they are for America. For us in New Jersey, it's three things. It's restoring and maintaining fiscal sanity. It's getting our pension and health benefits under control, reformed, and have the costs lowered. And it's reforming an education system that costs too much and produces too little for our society today and for our children's future. Now, if you look at those three issues, these are not, in and of themselves, Democratic or Republican issues. Each governor across America is confronting the same things that I'm confronting in New Jersey. A decade or more of out-of-control spending. In many, if not most states, state taxes that have been raised to new levels. Debt loads that are out of control, both for state entitlements and for just general borrowing. Every governor, Republican or Democrat, is facing this problem. And, you know, if you look at it, just look at our little area of the world. You have me in New Jersey elected in 2009 as a conservative Republican in one of the bluest states in America. And across the river, you have the son of a liberal icon who is saying the exact same things that I'm saying. I defy you to look at the first 6 weeks of the Cuomo administration in Albany and discern much of a difference between what Governor Andrew Cuomo is saying and what Governor Chris Christie is saying on these big issues. It's not because all of a sudden Governor Cuomo and I have decided that we're members of the same party. We're not. But we are confronted with the same problems. And these problems and issues are not partisan. They are obvious. And they are long overdue to be solved. And so that's why you see Andrew Cuomo or, for God's sake, even Jerry Brown in California talking about reducing salaries of state workers by 8 to 10%, saying the same things that Scott Walker is fighting in Wisconsin, that John Kasich is fighting in Ohio, that Rick Snyder is fighting in Michigan, that Susana Martinez is fighting in New Mexico. I said to the people of New Jersey when I ran for governor in 2009 that if they gave me the opportunity to be their governor, that not only would the state go on a path towards fiscal recovery, but we would also lead the nation because we had a one-year head start on everybody. Because of our odd election year, we would have a one-year head start on a huge new class of governors that would come in the election of 2010. Now, you can imagine how that was received in New Jersey. Now, this is a state that during my time as United States Attorney was known predominantly for a few things. Political corruption, The Sopranos, the Real Housewives of New Jersey, and now, most regrettably, the Jersey Shore. Not a place that thought of itself as a national leader in something that would matter for our children's future. But I believe part of leadership is understanding, articulating, and believing in that which is special and unique about the people you serve. And having been born in New Jersey and raised there and lived there all my life, I know that if presented with a challenge directly, without any sugarcoating, that the people of New Jersey would step up to the plate and answer the call. And after 13 months now as governor, I think we have plenty of evidence that we were right in 2009. When I came into office, we confronted a $2.2 billion budget deficit for fiscal year 10, the one that had 5 months left, the one that Governor Corzine told me was just fine, cruise path into the end of the fiscal year. Governor, don't worry about it. Everything is fine. $2.2 billion. My chief of staff in my first week as governor brought me a sheet of paper that showed me that if I did not act immediately to stop the planned spending, that New Jersey would not meet its payroll for the second pay period in March. Imagine that. The state that has the second highest per capita income in America had so overspent, overborrowed, and overtaxed that it would not meet payroll in March of 2010. So we acted immediately to use the executive authority of the governorship to impound $2.2 billion in projected spending without the permission of the legislature, without compromise, because it was not the time for compromise, and without raising taxes on the people of the state who have had their taxes raised and fees 115 times in the 8 years preceding my governorship. 115 tax and fee increases in 8 years. So we impounded spending and we balanced the budget. And we turned immediately towards this fiscal year that we're in now. And we're confronted with an $11 billion budget deficit on a $29 billion budget. The highest budget deficit by percentage of any state in America. And believe me, the partisan Democrats in my state believe they had me right where they wanted me. he would have to raise taxes. And they put it right down on the table. Said they wanted to increase the tax that they love the most, the income tax, and specifically, they called it the millionaire's tax. Now, of course, this leads me to have to give you an aside about New Jersey math. See, when Democrats in New Jersey call it a millionaire's tax, that's for anybody who makes $400,000 or over. That's called New Jersey math. So for businesses or individuals who had $400,000 in income or more, they wanted to raise their taxes again from a 9% top marginal rate to nearly 11%. And they told me that if I did not agree, they would close down the government. There would be no budget in 2011 without an income tax increase. Now, you know, this had happened 4 years earlier in New Jersey under Governor Corzine. They were arguing how much to raise taxes. And the Democrat-controlled legislature closed down the government on the Democratic governor because they couldn't agree how much to raise the sales tax. And Governor Corzine very famously invited the press into his office, now my office. And there was a cot in the office. I can tell you it's not normally there. And he said to them, I'm going to be sleeping in this cot right over here until this crisis is averted. So I knew that these were the same fellas who had been in the legislature when he was there, now threatening to do the same thing. So I decided to call them down early on and advise them that the place was under new management. And what I said to him was, listen, you guys want to pass that income tax increase? You can. That's fine. I'm going to veto it. And if you want to close down the government because of that, that's fine. But I want to tell you something. I'm not moving any cot into this office and sleeping here. You close down the government, I'm getting in those black SUVs with the troopers. I'm going to the governor's residence. I'm going to go upstairs. I'm going to open a beer. I'm going to order a pizza. I'm going to watch the Mets. And when you decide to reopen the government, give me a call and I'll come back. But I don't think I'm sleeping on some cot. Take a look at me. You think I'm sleeping on a cot? Not happening. So we stood up. We stood for our principles. We submitted a budget that cut real spending 9% year over year. Not projected growth. Real spending, 9%. Every department of state government was cut. And we balanced the budget without any new or increased taxes on the people of the state of New Jersey for the first time in 8 years. And the budget they called dead on arrival without an income tax increase was passed 2 days early with 99.8% of the line items exactly as they were when I submitted them back in March. With a Democratic legislature. Why? Because we stood up for what we believed in. And we made it very clear that we would not compromise on our principles. We'd compromise on things that were not core principle items, but we were not going to compromise on raising taxes on the people in New Jersey. That leads us now to today. And that's why fiscal discipline is so important. Because just because we went through that once, or one and a half, if you count fiscal year 10, doesn't mean we should be self-congratulatory, patting ourselves on the back and take our eye off the ball. This is a problem that took a decade to develop, and it's going to take longer than a year for us to fix it. So fiscal discipline is extraordinarily important, not only for New Jersey, but for America. Now we have a whole new way of budgeting in New Jersey. We don't assume every program will be funded any longer. We don't assume a certain increase in every budget. The Democratic legislature will come out and say, I have some $10 billion or so deficit for this year. That's because they're playing in the old playbook, which says that everything I did last year, of course, the next year I'd want to reverse and go right back. That is not going to happen. And it can't happen if states are going to progress and get out of this crisis. We now have to stick to a new type of approach to budgeting, budgeting from the bottom up, requiring, as I do now, of every one of my cabinet officers, that they come to me and not tell me what each one of their programs costs and how much they're willing to cut it, but to say to me, which one of your programs are absolutely necessary, and how much do you need to fund them. This is how much money you're getting, and whatever doesn't fit in your equation is out. We have to fund that which we really need, and to do that, we have to cut that which is just what we'd like rather than what we need. And you'll hear this debate going on down here now. And you'll have folks tell you that every bit of federal spending is absolutely necessary and laudatory. It's not. And in fact, some of it's not even laudatory, let alone necessary. But we have to bring a new approach and new discipline to this. And when people say that you can't tackle these big problems, look at what we're doing on pensions and benefits. Pensions and benefits are the equivalent of federal entitlements at the state level. They're no different. They have no more vocal constituency at the federal level than they do at the state level. Take my word for it. I rolled out my pension and benefit reform in September on a Tuesday, and then that Friday I went to the firefighters convention in Wildwood, New Jersey. 7,500 firefighters at 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. I think you know what they had for lunch. And I rolled out a very specific pension and benefit reform proposal on pensions, raise the retirement age, eliminate COLAs, increase the amount employees have to contribute to their pension every year, and roll back a 9% increase that was given to them by a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, and they had no way to pay for it. Those four reforms would take our current pension system, which is underfunded by $54 billion, and in 30 years cut it in half to $28 billion. Real reform getting us on the glide path to solvency. You can imagine how that was received by 7,500 firefighters. As I walked in the room and was introduced, I was booed lustily. I made my way up to the stage. They booed some more. I got to the microphone. They booed some more. And so I said, come on, you can do better than that. And they did. They did. And then I said to them, I took away the prepared notes I had for the speech. I actually took them off of the podium, crumbled them up, and threw them on the ground so they could see that I would. And I said, here's the deal. I understand you're angry. And I understand you're frustrated. And I understand you feel deceived and betrayed. And the reason you feel all those things is because you have been deceived and you have been betrayed. And for 20 years, governors have come into this room and lied to you. Promised you benefits that they had no way of paying for, making promises they knew they couldn't keep, and just hoping that they were the man or woman who wouldn't be left holding the bag. I understand why you feel angry and betrayed and deceived by those people. Here's what I don't understand. Why are you booing the first guy who came in here and told you the truth? See, there's no political advantage to me coming into that room and telling the truth the way we used to think about politics, and unfortunately the way I fear they're thinking about politics still in Washington, D.C. See, the old playbook says lie, deceive, obfuscate, make it to the next election. You know, there's a study that says by 2020, New Jersey is one of 11 states that's pension could be bankrupt. And when I told a friend of mine about that study, he said to me, well, wait, 2020? You won't be governor. What the hell do you care? That's the way politics has been practiced in our country for too long and practiced in New Jersey for too long. And so I said to those firefighters, you may hate me now, but 15 years from now, when you have a pension to collect because of what I did, you'll be looking for my address on the internet to send me a thank you note. Leadership today in America has to be about doing the big things and being courageous. That's what it has to be about. Same thing with health benefit reform, which is an analogy to Medicaid and Medicare here in Washington. And if you think that the public workers in New Jersey hold on any less strongly to the benefits that they get through the government, teachers in New Jersey who pay nothing for their health insurance, nothing, from the day they're hired until the day they die, for full family medical coverage that costs the state of New Jersey $24,000 per family. you don't think they're holding on to that tight, you're not paying attention. The battles are similar. And here's the problem. You can't fix these problems if you don't talk about them. You cannot fix these problems without talking about them. And I look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now, and I'm worried. And I think, you know, I heard the President's State of the Union speech, and it was 2 weeks after mine, and he said America was about doing the big things. Now, listen, I'm not saying he copied me. See some writing about that, and that's what I'm saying. But I think it's important to note it because of what he says the big things are. He says the big things are high-speed rail. The big things are high-speed internet access for, what was it, 80% of America or something by some date. 1 million electric cars on the road by some date. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the candy of American politics. Those are not the big things. Because let me guarantee you something. If we don't fix the real big things, there's going to be no electric cars on the road. There's going to be no high-speed internet access, or if there is, you're not going to be able to afford to get on it. We're not going to be able to care about the niceties of life, the investments that Washington wants to continue to make. That's not what we need to be talking about. No one is talking about it. And now what this has become, I read, is a political strategy. The president's not talking about it because he's waiting for the Republicans to talk about it. And our new bold Republicans that we just sent to the House of Representatives, they're not talking about it because they're waiting for him to talk about it. Let me suggest to you that my children's future and your children's future is more important than some political strategy. Let me suggest to you that what game is being played down here is irresponsible and it's dangerous. We need to say these things and we need to say them out loud. When we say we're cutting spending, when we say everything's on the table, when we say we mean entitlement programs, we should be specific. And let me tell you, what is the truth? What's the truth that nobody's talking about? Here's the truth that nobody's talking about. You're going to have to raise the retirement age for Social Security. Oh, I just said it, and I'm still standing here. I did not vaporize into the carpeting, and I said it. We have to reform Medicare because it costs too much, and it is going to bankrupt us. Once again, lightning did not come through the windows and strike me dead. And we have to fix Medicaid because it's not only bankrupting the federal government, it's bankrupting every state government. There you go. If we're not honest about these things, on the state level about pensions and benefits, and on the federal level about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, we are on the path to ruin. And, you know, now I hear people saying, we're going too fast. We need to slow down a little bit. You know, I hear the same thing in New Jersey. In New Jersey all the time, the legislature says, the legislature is a deliberative body. We need to study the governor's proposals. You know, I never worked in Trenton before I became governor, and they do speak a different language in state capitals and in this capital. They speak different languages. So you need to get, when you become governor, and no one tells you this, but you need to get your English to Trenton dictionary. Because the language in Trenton is just much different. See, when a legislature, and I don't care whether this is the Congress or whether this is the state legislature in New Jersey, when they say, we need to study the executive's proposal, you think, because you speak English, that that means they're going to take some time to really look at it, consider it, and then act. No, no, no. What that means in Trenton and what I suspect it means in Washington also is this. It means we are going to drag our feet for as long as we can until we hope it dies a natural death. Because God knows we don't want our fingerprints on it for murdering it, but we also don't have the guts to do it. That's what study means in government parlance. And so in New Jersey, they call me impatient. call me lots of other things, too. But they call me impatient, among other things. Ladies and gentlemen, I think it's time for some impatience. I think it's some time for some impatience in America. Because if you think we're moving too slow, think about these statistics. The deficit stands at $1.6 trillion. The Social Security system is going to be insolvent in 2037. And Medicare is expected to run out of money in 2017. So I'm impatient because I want them to act now, because I want our healthcare system to be secure for the future, because I want our retirement system to be secure for the future. See, one of the things that the public sector unions don't understand about my approach in New Jersey is they think I'm attacking them. I'm attacking the leadership of the union because they're greedy and they're selfish and self-interested. The members of that union are being ill-served by the leadership of that union. And so when I say what I'm doing is to save your pension, to save your health care for the rest of your life. And yeah, you're going to have to take a little less. That's the way it goes. We're in difficult times, and there were promises made that couldn't be kept. But it's no longer time to wait. And leadership, in my opinion, is not about waiting. You know, I get 4 years as governor of New Jersey. I don't have time to wait. And anybody who leads a government, whether it's in another state or in America, has a defined period of time to act. And now I understand that this political strategy in Washington is all about waiting out to 2012. That's 5 years away from Medicare insolvency. And what's the excuse going to be then? You know, these are hard things to do. They are hard things to do, but they're not impossible to do. And here's what politicians fear. What politicians fear is you do these things, like say what I just said, you'll be vaporized into the carpet politically. That's what they're afraid of. But look at what's happened again in New Jersey and in New York. I was elected with 49% of the vote in a three-way race in November 2009, the first Republican elected to statewide office in 12 years in New Jersey. But not with a majority, 49% of the vote. And when I started to say we were going to cut K-12 education funding by more than $1 billion, we were going to cut municipal aid by more than $500 million, we were going to cut every program that we could find in government and balance without raising taxes, I had everybody telling me, Governor, you can't do it. Your approval ratings will go in the toilet. People love these programs. And what I said to people was, you know what? I'm going to try an experiment here. Let's start treating the people of New Jersey like adults. Because you think they don't know that we are in deep trouble? Then these are not the people that I knew growing up. These are tough, smart, self-aware people who understand that we've dug ourselves a hole for more than a decade and that you only are going to get out by climbing. And climbing is hard, really hard. But it's time to do it. And what's happened? After 13 months of fighting and arguing and pushing and impatience, my approval rating's at 54%. No disaster. In fact, more popular today than I was the day I was elected. And that's in a state that is as Democratic as any state in America for a Republican governor. But if you really want to see eye-popping numbers, look across the river at the person who was recently characterized as my soulmate. I wonder how he feels about that. Governor Andrew Cuomo, in a poll that just came out 2 days ago, his job approval is at 77%. 77%. And all he's talked about is cutting spending, not raising taxes, addressing entitlement programs, Medicaid, pensions, taking on public sector unions, capping school superintendent pay. The hard things, the things that people tell you will lead to political ruin, they don't. Politicians make this mistake all the time. They run last election next time. They think that what happened before will happen again. And they don't look around them to see that the times have changed. Our country and our states are weighed down by an albatross of irresponsibility that we have foisted upon ourselves as leaders and that you, as citizens, have permitted us to get away with. The last example of that is education reform, and all I'll say about this is that in my state, where we spend $17,620 per pupil per year, the highest in America, $24,000 per pupil in the city of Newark, $28,000 in Asbury Park, and we have 104,000 students trapped in 200 failing schools across New Jersey, and the education establishment says, don't worry, help's on the way. And the help that's on the way is more money. More money. Well, more money's not going to solve this problem until we take on the issues that are really causing the problem. And until we as Americans are willing to do that final tough thing, which is to look the teachers' union across America in the eye and say to them, you do not represent the best that teachers have to offer. You often represent the worst. And it's time for us to honestly say that we can separate the teachers from the union. We have great teachers in New Jersey working hard and making a huge difference in the lives of many children, but we don't have enough of them. And one of the reasons that we don't have enough of them is because the bad teachers who remain with lifetime tenure are crowding out the opportunity for the good ones. And then when you have reductions, the last ones in are the first ones out because all that matters is seniority and not talent. And so we send a new generation of teachers, good, enthusiastic teachers, away. Because we have built a system, as Michelle Reed put, better than I could, that cares more about the feelings of adults than it cares about the future of our children. I will not take responsibility for that approach. I will not take responsibility for leaving a generation of children behind in America. I won't do it. And we need to speak out and say it's time to fix that system. Tell me where else in America, really there's two places, left in America, where there's a profession where there is no reward for excellence and no consequence for failure. Of course, we all know the first one is weathermen. Right? It doesn't matter. It's going to snow 6 inches. It snows 18. Well, I said it was going to snow. What's the difference? And they're right back on TV the next night. Unfortunately, the second one is teaching. Because the great teacher, the only reward they get is the psychic reward of knowing that they've done a great job for the children in their classroom. And the teacher next door, who's the lousy teacher who doesn't care, gets paid the same as the teacher who stays late and comes early, the same as the teacher who communicates with parents, the same as the teacher who feels it's his or her personal responsibility to lift each child up to the next grade. That's not what America is. America is built on rewarding excellence and having consequence for failure. So we need to deal with that issue as well, not only in every state, but in America. You know, there's a lot of talk now about partisanship and the negative, angry tone in some of our political debates. And there is a time and a place for partisanship. I absolutely believe in that. And so did our founding fathers. They believed in partisanship. They believed in vigorous debate, and so do I. You know, it's the nature of our country, based on our founding, to have principled disagreements among people of goodwill. And I'm not disagreeing with folks just for the sake of disagreeing. And I am not fighting for the sake of fighting. I fight for the things that matter. I save my energy for the fights of consequence. And as a result, some people say I'm too combative. Some people say I'm too much of a fighter. Well, I'll tell you, I'm fighting now because now is the time that it matters the most in New Jersey's future and in America's future. We are teetering on the edge of disaster. And I love when people talk about American exceptionalism. But American exceptionalism has to include the courage to do the right thing. It cannot just be a belief that because we're exceptional, everything will work out okay. Part of truly being exceptional is being willing to do the difficult things, to stop playing the political games, to stop looking at the bumper pool of politics, and to step up and start doing the right thing. This is the new era that we new elected officials have inherited. Whether we like it or not, that's the story. And we have two choices. To either stand up and do the right thing, to speak the truth and speak it bluntly and directly, or to join the long parade of leaders who have come before us and failed. And maybe people won't remember us. And maybe they won't pin the responsibility for failure on us because there's been so much failure around us. But I did not run for this job for failure. I ran for this job for success. For success not just for me personally and my children, but success for my state. And hopefully to provide an example for the rest of the country that you can do the difficult things. See, it seems to me that what America is really all about is about a group of people who came from every corner of this earth because they wanted a chance for greatness. That's what's made us the greatest country on earth. Our calling for greatness at this time is to confront these issues, to say them out loud, to stop playing around, and to not waste another minute. You know, the World War II generation was called the greatest generation. And they were because they put their lives on the line to protect our way of life. And they're called the greatest generation because we judged them. We judged them in the aftermath. And we found them to be great by any objective measure. Let me guarantee you one thing, we will be judged too. We will be judged by our children and our grandchildren. But at this moment of crisis, what did we do? Did we bury our heads in the sand? Did we surround ourselves with our creature comforts and believe that just because we're America, everything's going to be okay? Or will our children and grandchildren be able to say, at this moment of crisis, we stood up and did the hard things that made a future of greatness possible for them? Believe me, we'll be judged. I know the way I want that judgment to turn out for me. And I know in the hearts and the minds of most New Jerseyans and Americans I know how they want that judgment to turn out for them. It's time for us to get to work to find our greatness again. And I believe we will find our greatness through doing the big things, the really big things, that will lead America to another century of exceptionalism and not a century of settling for second best. That's what this fight's about. If you're willing to join me, I'm willing to join you. And that's why I came down here today to talk to you. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you. I think we have some time for a few questions. So there's a microphone there, but you right there. And this, oh, okay, we're back there. Whichever one. There you go. Yes, sir.
Jamie Weinstein from the Daily Caller. By your own accounting, Medicaid will be in the red in 2017. Which means the change that needs to begin has to begin now or by the next election cycle. You've already said you don't plan to run for president in 2012, but no matter what you do in New Jersey to fix the fiscal situation, it doesn't matter if Washington doesn't get it right for the nation. Is there any conceivable scenario where you would see the field as not talking about these big issues that you're talking about and say, I'm the only one talking about it, and the time is now, I must run?
Well, that took a long time, didn't it? I was talking to my wife this morning. I was down here in D.C. I was talking to my wife this morning, and I was telling her there's Q&A after I give this speech. And she said to me, you don't think they're going to ask you about running for president, do you? And I said, no. Listen, I threatened to commit suicide. I did. I said, what do I have to do short of suicide to convince people I'm not running? Apparently, I actually have to commit suicide to convince people I'm not running. Listen, you heard what I just said, and it comes from the heart. And it's what I really believe. So then you also have to believe me when I say to you that you have to feel in your heart and in your mind that you're ready for the presidency. And there are lots of people who will run just because the opportunity presents itself. And I'm not stupid. I see the opportunity. I see it. That's not the reason to run. And I think all too often that's why people do run. It's just because they see the opportunity. Well, when will I ever get this opportunity again? Let's go. That's not a reason to be president of the United States. You have to believe in your heart and in your soul and in your mind that you are ready. And I don't believe that about myself right now. So that's why I said I won't run. And, you know, I can't imagine that changing. You know, add to the fact the two other things. First is that I made a commitment to the people of the state of New Jersey. And believe me, after a year, despite the fact that we made great progress, we're nowhere near fixed. And I got a lot of work to do, and I feel extraordinarily challenged and energized by the job in New Jersey. And I want to do the best I can to finish that job. And third, my wife will kill me. She'll just kill me. We're going to be married 25 years in 2 weeks. And, you know, there's certain things, once you've been married 25 years, you're kind of locked in, you know. And there's certain things that you know just will not be accepted, and I think that's on the list. So, yes, sir, in the back. I thought you were a great-looking guy.
Maybe the only idea that one of your predecessors had, which seemed to me to make sense, having grown up in New Jersey, this idea of consolidating a lot of these small towns. I grew up in a town of 10,000 people, 1 square mile. We had 3 or 4 right next to us. I mean, if you think about the duplication, the town governments, the police forces, the fire departments, I suspect that that idea of your predecessors is now still being studied. But
it
is. I just wonder if that's something that you think is still a viable option in New Jersey.
I do, but I want to do it a different way. You know, Governor Corzine's method was to try to force consolidation on people from a central office in Trenton. And my idea is to say we've put a 2% cap on property taxes, a hard cap on property taxes. We put a 2% cap on any interest arbitration awards to public workers. And now municipalities are going to have to make some really hard choices. And one of those things they're going to have to consider is shared services or ultimately consolidation, because it's going to be very difficult to fit under that 2% cap without doing some of those things. And so, but I want the localities to decide that. I mean, listen, I'm sitting in Trenton. I live in Mendham Township, New Jersey. It is a town of 5,000 people, and it's shaped in a horseshoe. Inside the horseshoe is Mendham Borough, New Jersey, another 5,000 people. When the township went to the borough to say, let's talk about consolidating our police forces, you would have thought that there was an uprising happening inside the town. If that gets imposed from Trenton, it will have no validity. And they'll fight it just for the sake of fighting it. It's part of New Jersey's character, as you know, from having been there. I want them to come to their own conclusion on it. Because if you want to control property taxes, that's one of the things you're going to have to consider. But I'm giving them the option. You've got a 2% cap. And the only way to violate that 2% cap is to go to the voters and get them to vote to exceed the 2% cap. In the current environment, I find that unlikely. And so they're going to have to make some hard choices. That's why I hope to force the consideration of shared services between towns where appropriate and consolidation of towns where they deem it appropriate. Yes, in the second row.
Caitlin Korb from the Cato Institute. Republican governors have responded very, very differently to Judge Vinson's ruling on the constitutionality of Obamacare. How are you going to alter your approach to the implementation of Obamacare in light of the recent court decision?
Well, one of the things we did is all of the Republican governors have written a letter to Attorney General Holder asking the administration to ask the Supreme Court to take the case immediately. The implications of having to implement a law that is still in dispute are significant, and we should just get this thing to the Supreme Court and get it decided. Slow walking this creates real trouble for governors because, you know, depending upon what your attorney general is going to say, depending upon what your law department is going to say about what you have to do or not do in response to the whole variety of different judgments that have been made on this, makes it really difficult for us. And I think that's why we want to try to get it to the Supreme Court and get it decided. I mean, I haven't made any secret of the fact that I'm not a fan of the president's health care plan or of some of the mandates that it places on states and flexibility that it takes away from us on issues like Medicaid and others. But what we're doing right now is we're complying with the law. We're doing what our legal counsel is telling us we need to do. But we're begging for someone to clarify the law quickly. And the only people who are going to do that are the nine folks who sit over at the Supreme Court. And so I hope that they get it there sooner rather than later. I hope that this is not another political strategy to slow walk this thing to try to make it inevitable. Because I could tell you,